Welcome to the weekly Dharma Talk podcast from the Columbus Karma Teksum Choling Buddhist Meditation Center. This week's Dharma Talk is entitled Hindrances to Meditation and Practice by Lama Tom Broadwater. In Buddhism, there are said to be five hindrances or mind states that inhibit our meditation. They are agitation, torpor or laziness, ill will, attraction or desire, and doubt. Lama Tom defines each of these hindrances, examines their causes, and details some remedies we can apply to help clear the way for successful practice. If you like our Dharma Talk series, please consider donating to Columbus Karma Teksum Choling at columbusktc.org. Enjoy the podcast.
I want to say good afternoon and welcome. I'm Tom Broadwater, assisting Lama at Columbus KTC. I hope you're well. Your week went well, and I hope that next week goes equally well for you. This past week, Lama Kathy and Lama Adam and I had the pleasure of celebrating the groundbreaking at the New Columbus, Ohio Buddhist Center. We're really excited about that. Hopefully it's going to be completed within the year. And we're looking forward to that. I'd also say you could go to the Facebook page for the center and look at what's going on there. And if you have the mind to make a donation, we're still needing funds to complete the building. So anything you could contribute, however small it may be, would be helpful. So in advance, I want to thank you for the gift of your time and your attention. And I sincerely hope that whatever I have to say here, there'll be something that you can take away with you and assist you in your practice. This is going to be a relatively short talk, and it's entitled Hindrances to Meditation and Practice. In traditional Buddhism, there is said to be five hindrances or mind states that inhibit our meditation. They are variously translated, but generally they are described as agitation, torpor, or laziness, ill will, and attraction, and finally doubt. So we'll go into all of those and look at them and see how they hurt or make difficult our meditation. We'll define these terms a little more clearly and look at some of the causes of these mind states. And finally, look at some remedies for those mind states. My own personal experience has been that if I'm experiencing an afflictive state on the cushion, especially if they reoccur time after time, those same mind states are probably predominating in my life off the cushion. So I think there is some value in looking at these states a little bit as they manifest even off the cushion. So we'll do that. I have one disclaimer. Nothing I say here is going to be original. At best, I'm sort of like a parrot of our lineage masters. I do my best to channel the power of their thoughts, but you know, I do the best I can. So to make a long story short, most of my talk is from the masters, and I'll be quoting a great deal from them. We may come to this space for all kinds of reasons, the space of Dharma. Maybe it's curiosity, maybe it's by accident, But for whatever reason, we should always attempt to set a proper motivation. A good motivation is establishing a clear purpose for our actions. If we have a good motivation, it's more likely we will have a good outcome to any activity we begin. So for Buddhists, we take our motivation is to benefit all beings. And we begin first by taking refuge in the Buddha, his teachings, and the community of his followers. And that we make a pledge that we will practice virtue and awaken in all this for the benefit of beings. So we will start with refuge and bodhicitta. Sanje chidam sakhi chopnam la janchu badu dagi kyapsu chi dagi jin so chi pe so nam ki drola pinchu sanje drupar sho sanje chidam sakhi chopnam la Janchu badu dagi kapsu chi dagi jinso chi pei sonam ki drola pinchir sanje drupar sho sanje chudon saki chodam la janchu badu dagi kapsu chi Dagi jinso jipe sonam ki Drola pinchir sanje drupar sho. So the primary objective is this talk is to look at the five hindrances in meditation and a brief look at how these same states manifest off the cushion. But first, let's take a little look at meditation and why we meditate. If we were to observe our thoughts for even just one day, we would notice the sheer number of all of our thoughts going through our heads. Just think of the number of thoughts you've had just since waking up. Furthermore, as Trungpa Rinpoche has observed in the ocean of ultimate meaning, we might, and I quote here, we might begin to see that most of the multitude of thoughts we have are meaningless and unhappy thoughts. Thoughts of worry and fear, anger and jealousy, regrets about the past and fears about the future. Furthermore, many of those same thoughts are actually harmful to ourselves and others. So I challenge you to observe your thoughts for one day and see if Trungpa Rinpoche's statement is true. I think you'll find that it really is true. So if we reduce the number of these thoughts, that would probably be beneficial to us, wouldn't you say? If we had fewer thoughts, because most of our thoughts are harmful, unhappy thoughts. So if we could reduce that, that'd probably be beneficial. So many people are drawn to meditation based upon their desire to extricate themselves from these neurotic and painful thoughts that are really a pattern. So I see many come to the cushion already pretty weary and exhausted. According to Trungpa Rinpoche, when shamatha is fully achieved, now I'm saying here, fully achieved, all these purposeless thoughts cease while the meaningful thoughts become stronger and clearer. And in that way, we know through greater understanding what thoughts to be, what needs to be done, and what thoughts are appropriate to get things done. There are many people who may find meditation a refreshing respite from the hell they have created with their meaningless and harmful thoughts. But many soon encounter mind states that disturb them in their meditation. Thinking that meditation is always supposed to be a pleasant experience, they may become discouraged and give up that effort. And that happens. I sometimes had people that I've been mentoring and go along very well and then come to a roadblock and decide that it's too difficult because they don't recognize the hindrances and how to deal with them. So often meditation does take some unexpected effort. In fact, it is said that we are likely at some level or another to experience these hindrances for a long, long time, even till we reach the highest levels of meditation. For example, restlessness is oftentimes said to be something that even the highest meditators experience to a subtle degree. I have known some, again, who stop because they don't think they're making progress. And I'll talk about these situations towards the end of this talk, using Kimpo Carter Rinpoche's words to help those veteran meditators and discouraged beginners. But here, my point is that most of us experience some degree of difficulty during our meditation career. So let's again review those states. What are they? They're called desire or attraction and ill will, torpor or laziness and restlessness, and finally doubt. If the practitioner looks closely, they may find that these same states exist in their lives off the cushion. After all, we are not two different people, one on the cushion and one off the cushion. Maybe the most sobering first lesson we learn is that we cannot escape these states magically by falling onto the cushion. Calming the mind is a process, and our progress to reducing unnecessary, useless, and harmful thoughts and gaining clarity in the remaining thoughts that we do have is difficult and is also determined by many factors. And we'll touch on the overarching reason we might not progress in the latter half of this talk. But right now, let's go back and look at these hindrances one by one and see what we can do to work through them. First, sensory desire or attraction. This is what how it's referred to. The late Trolling Rinpoche, in his Essence of Buddhism, and I'm going to quote him a lot here, Trolling Rinpoche notes that our minds have a tendency to latch onto things that we are attracted to. That's for sure. Any object of the five senses, what we see, smell, touch, taste, feel, can become an object of addiction and attraction. And we can find that both on the cushion and off the cushion. After all, we live in what is called the desire realm. Buddhists call it the realm we currently live in, as humans, the desire realm. And we're going to be frequently captured by what we are attracted to, sometimes in an obsessive and even in an addictive way. And so if that's the case, our minds are not clear when we are attracted to things and hooked on them, and we're not free. The question every practitioner in post-meditation could ask themselves is, where does my mind wander when I'm off the cushion? And what do I most attend to when I am off the cushion? What do I pay attention to mostly during the day? What kind of distractions am I involved in? It might be very interesting to experiment with that. We waste so much of our time on so many useless distractions. Being mindful of that, are there any patterns you might see? Do I focus my attention on certain things at certain times of the day and so forth? The same thing applies in meditation. Recognition of these patterns is the very first step to working on them. We have to recognize them. So often we just sort of go around in a muddle from one thought to another. But we have to apply awareness, we have to apply mindfulness to our lives in order to break out of these mindless, hurtful thoughts. On my iPhone, there's a feature that pops up once a week telling me how much time I spent on the internet and where I spent that time. We might do an informal calculation ourselves. How much time have I spent on this or that thought of resentment, anger, whatever? You know, how productive was that thought? What activity or thought substitutes might I use to reduce the frequency of that thought or behavior? During the pandemic, when many of us have been restricted in our public activities, we've had a unique opportunity to practice. So where have we placed our attention during that time? You know, how many useless projects have we gotten involved in? How much time have we wasted? Notice whether there was more practice or proliferation of entertainments. There's nothing wrong with entertainments, don't get me wrong. But if we have extra time, look where we use it and where could we use it better. And consciously intend to make some changes based on your mindful observation of your behavior. An additional remedy is to notice how quickly sensory objects grab our attention and facilitate the maintaining of a mind that lacks clarity. Then notice what mind states we are left with once we have indulged. Notice the temporary nature of all pleasure. We are always disappointed when any pleasurable thing ends. So we need to look at this aspect to desire. And so initiating continuously and maintaining these thoughts on the cushion and totally abandoning ourselves to them off the cushion is an endless and futile effort for perpetual pleasure in things that are transitory. We want happiness. We want ultimate happiness. And by their very nature, things that are impermanent or transitory can't provide that. And that thought can help us overcome our addiction to these pleasurable thoughts as an addiction. Another potential, depending on our development, is to look at the thought, whatever it arises, on or off the cushion, to look at it directly and without putting further energy into it, just let it dissolve. So whatever thought comes up, there it is, you see it, in the mind's eye, you see it. You don't put further energy into it. And if you don't put further energy into it, because of its temporary nature, it's going to dissolve. Of course, the primary instruction in meditation is not to suppress thoughts, but to return each time to the object or focus of our meditation. Finally, it's important to note that our obsession and endless pursuit of what we desire often sets the stage for problems and for endless destructive thoughts in meditation. So it's a task of the meditator to recognize these patterns. The next hindrance is sensory desire's opposite, ill will or aversion. The late Charlie Rinpoche says, ill will refers to all kinds of thoughts that arise related to wanting to reject. Just simply that. So we're in meditation and there's this feeling of rejection, a thought arises of rejection. It may be feelings of hostility, resentment, hatred, bitterness, resentment. I've actually talked to practitioners who tell me that sometimes these thoughts, particularly when they're strong, have pervaded their lives and their time on the cushion for months at a time. And it's often because of some disturbing event in their lives. So the first thing is to notice how these thoughts and feelings are robbing us of happiness, clarity of mind, a sense of freedom. For example, if we're thinking resentful thoughts, the person who's being resented or the event that we're resentful of, by our continually going over that story, no one's being hurt but us, ourselves. And what's further happening is we're being robbed of the clarity of mind, the absence of this aversion would have. A mind of ill will is a mind that becomes small and unable to relax. On the cushion, we treat aversion as any other thought and return to the breath. At the same time, if that thought is reoccurring and disturbing our ability to actually meditate, then we might want to try Tong Lin, which is mind training meditation that develops our love and compassion. And this is particularly good when it's a person we're resenting or being angry at or being upset with. So Tong Lin, offering them your goodness, your kindness, taking on their suffering, will put your anger and your frustration and your resentment in an entirely different context. It's if you put your heart and soul into that Tong Lin for that person, I assure you that over time, your resentment, your anger will decrease. Lama Kathy has extensively talked on that subject, and I refer you to some of her YouTube things on Tong Lin. I really think you would benefit from that if you're finding resentment or anger a problem. It's really through the unique alchemy of this practice, Tong Lin, that over time you can change your anger and resentment, you really can, into love and compassion and understanding. If off the cushion, these thoughts of resentment persist and interfere with your daily functioning, finding a good spiritual friend or a counselor may be needed to overcome this afflictive state. There is no shame in that. There are times that the hurt has been so deep, the anger is so deep-seated, we just need to talk to somebody else about it. And a spiritual friend, a lama, or a counselor, particularly if it's a mental health issue, that's what you should do. The next hindrance we look at is tupor. It's sluggishness, and arises when it arises, we lose our focus, and we have no mental clarity. And I'm sure all of us have experienced that at some time or another in meditation. I will have to admit, sometimes in retreat, during meditations, and don't tell this to anybody, I keep this under your hat here, but sometimes in retreat, during meditation, I would actually fall asleep. The instruction here is to raise your gaze, to put your eyes skyward, and maybe tighten the body muscles a little bit, at least temporarily. Sometimes we are instructed to visualize a bright light ascending above our heads to meditate. Other times we can actually power through it. There are times it just takes a critical point. If we wait a little bit of time, something, chemicals in our body and our brain sort of kick in, and we become awake and clarity returns. So if we can power through it, that's good too. But in the end, Trolic Rinpoche says, if that state persists, it's best just to get up and walk around a little bit, maybe put some cold water on your face. And if you're, particularly if you're starting to fall asleep. Now, if your sluggishness interferes with your daily function, we need to notice how much sleep we're getting and what kind of foods we're eating. And again, if it's chronic sluggishness, that may be some underlying symptom of either a physical or a mental disturbance, and you need to look at it from that perspective too. Next, we'll look at sluggishness's opposite, it's restlessness. It's sort of an edginess in our bodies. Thoughts that go round and round in the mind, thoughts of what we might be doing or what we have done or what we will be doing. Also, there can be thoughts of regret and fear and worry, and these just cause an agitated state. It's like we are of two minds. One of us is wanting to meditate, and then there is this separate part of us that is restless and wanting to move about. So it's like we're split in half. The remedy for this hindrance begins with consciously relaxing the body posture and lowering the gaze. Now that sounds a little odd, but oftentimes this restlessness manifests in our body as being really tight, and it's also a tight mind. So just relaxing the body, relaxing the mind, relaxing the gaze, that can be very beneficial. Trungpa Rinpoche in Ocean of Ultimate Meaning mentioned another method to deal with restlessness and sluggishness. and by cutting through these thoughts of whatever they are. And we cut through them by a method called beating the pig's nose. So if in old Tibet a pig entered the garden and let roam, your garden was destroyed. So the gardener would take a stick and hit, not real hard, but hit it, the most tender part of the pig, which is his nose, and the pig would go away. And so what Trungpa Rinpoche is recommending is when these thoughts of restlessness come up, all of a sudden recognize and say, no, I'm going to stop. In fact, using that word might be helpful. Milarepa, the great yogi of Tibet, was once asked why he was always going around yelling, pick. And he said it was a Sanskrit word meaning to sever or cut. So when anything agitating or disturbing arose in Milarepa's mind, he would exclaim, pick. So you can cut through the continuity of these thoughts by a loud exclamation. And it does work. You're striking the pig with a stick. Finally, we come to the hindrance of doubt. Doubt is a nagging feeling. How do I know I'm doing this right? That happens with people in Nyendro. It happens people all the time in terms of practices. Am I doing this right? How do I know if this is going to work? How do I know more seriously, how do I know the teachings are true and are my teachers deluded? I mean, some people have those thoughts. So the most obvious remedy for many doubts is making sure we correctly understand the practice or teachings. Asking questions in this case is most important. Once one knows the instructions precisely, additional doubts may be resolved through the practice itself. Whether it works or not is something that you find out in process. Simply doing the practice wholeheartedly can result in resolution of doubts. Off the cushion, when these doubts about the teacher comes up, you resolve those doubts through developing trust in your teacher, and that's a period of time. It's not something, not like, usually, it's not like one day I'd see the teacher and all of a sudden I have total trust. It may take a period of time. And you basically are looking to see whether the teacher embodies the teachings and whether those teachings that he gives or she gives are authentic teachings. Sometimes doubt is a part of our overall indecisiveness. So here it's a matter of working on one's confidence. One of the biggest problems in practice is not the teachings, nor the teacher. We have confidence in those, but having confidence in ourselves may be the biggest problem. And one of the remedies to that is to review, to go back to those teachings on Buddha nature. So far, we've addressed the five hindrances. We've looked at them on and off the cushion because essentially we are the same person both on and off. Our habitual thoughts and feelings enter our meditation with us. We can't help that. We've given some general advice based upon our lineage master's instructions. We can have confidence in their advice. But often, as we move along in our practice and meditation, we may need individual attention. In that case, we should consult with a trusted veteran meditator, and there are a number of those at Columbus KTC, or one of the lamas, Lama Kathy, Lama Adam, and myself, and that can be quite helpful. So I'd like now to talk about another problem that oftentimes we don't like to mention. And that's, why don't we make progress? And that can happen to the beginner as well as those who've practiced for many years. There are practitioners who look after many years of practice and say, I really don't see that I made much progress. So we need to look at that. As veteran practitioners, rather than dealing with that issue of our practice, we simply become complacent and maybe even a little cynical, but at the same time, maintain this Dharma facade. So what might be the underlying problem here? Rather than look at others' sudden departures or the cynicism of veterans, let's look at why we, me and you, might not be making the progress we'd like to make. Before I do that, I want to say something about, I think it would be helpful to acknowledge how fortunate you and I are that we have a teachings available to us. Even in this pandemic, there are teachers and monasteries who are making a concerted effort to bring the teachings to us in very innovative ways and bring it to us in our social isolation. And we can be very grateful for that. So there are many opportunities for you and me to learn. Actually, these teachings seem to be flourishing on the internet right now. But here's the point. Learning opportunities are not sufficient. We may attend hundreds of retreats and listen to hours of Dharma talks and do so for years. But as Kempo Karcha Rinpoche has said in a remarkable talk he gave over 30 years ago at KDD Monastery, he said, simply to listen to Dharma is insufficient. It is like being ill and the doctor gives us medicine and we just look at the medicine. That is insufficient to cure the illness. We need to practice. But authentic practice, effective practice, requires one very important ingredient. To make fully authentic progress in our Dharma, an effective personal requirement is detachment, a word we don't like to use. It doesn't sound good to our ears. We don't like to hear this word detachment. But it's detachment from meaningless thoughts, meaningless activity in samsara. We often come to Dharma in personal crisis and suffering. We get some relief and we forget that the very nature of samsara is suffering. As our lineage prayer states, detachment is the foot of practice. Detachment from the meaninglessness of our thoughts, the meaninglessness of so many of our distractions. If detachment is the legs of our meditation, we certainly cannot walk into our practice without it. according to Rinpoche, when we place our faith and our precious attention on samsaric pursuits, we are inevitably disappointed. Well, of course. Why? Because when we are placing our ultimate hope and happiness in worldly projects, we are placing our hopes in what is impermanent, transitory, and mixed with afflictive emotions. I did not ever hear Rinpoche say that we, lay, should be monk renunciates. He never told us that. Rather, he encouraged us to live by our vows, our lay precepts, our vows that we've taken as a bodhisattva. He told us to be fully committed to that. But it's not that you and I have to be that sort of renunciate, that sort of detachment. That's not in our karma. And I'd also say that this detachment does not mean that we avoid any social engagement. Karmapa often talks about the environment, poverty, and human rights. Some of Rinpoche's and Karmapa's greatest lay disciples, in fact, are effectively engaged in social projects, making contributions to global welfare and betterment. So I dare say they are making those based upon their detachment from worldly concerns such as fame and gain and reputation. In this case, detachment does not mean apathy. Remember how we began this talk? The enormous number of meaningless thoughts that we have each day. The endless and meaningless distractions of samsara we engage in. Our detachment needs to be focused on these. Detachment does not mean we run away from our situation. Another quality we need to have in order to meditate is devotion. And that can be seen at different levels. And devotion does not mean some sort of feeble piety. Devotion is very hearty. It's a strong interest in what? In our own liberation. We know, because of the Four Noble Truths, we know samsara is defined by suffering. And so we become detached. We want to become detached from that suffering. And we want to be devoted to the pursuit of our liberation. And that's what we're doing in Dharma practice. Knowing the nature of suffering as pervading all samsara, we're eager, enthusiastic to be liberated from it. I don't know about you, but I remember those first days coming to the center at Columbus and being so innervated by the excitement that here I was entering the Dharma path. And part of what we need to do sometimes is recollect why we came to Dharma, why we came to practice, why we came to the center. Finally, we're at some point, we need to be devoted to our teachers who can point out what is liberating based upon their experience and realization. You might say devotion is simply the flip side of detachment. When I was in Rinpoche's three-year retreat 12 years ago, I would sometimes note with dismay my lack of devotion and detachment. You know, it's like you carry that in with you. It's not a, you're not a different person when you go into retreat. And he gave me one piece of advice, which I imagine he gave to others too. He said, when your devotion is lagging, or you become obsessed with meaningless samsaric activity and lack of detachment, meditate on the four thoughts. He said, it did not matter how long you've been practicing, if you feel you're not progressing, return to the four thoughts. Meditating on those four thoughts can help most Dharma students. And it certainly helped me in the beginning. It helped me when I was in retreat. And on occasion, it helps me now. And those thoughts are, and I paraphrase, and they're not, you find different translations of them, but the first thought is, life is precious. We are alive. We have this opportunity to wake up to reality as it truly is. And you and I can seize this opportunity to wake up. The second thought is, but life is impermanent, transitory. It's like as effervescent as ephemeral, I should say. As bubbles on the mountain stream, as the saying goes. So we shouldn't waste our time. We should start now. It doesn't matter where you are in terms of your progress. It doesn't matter. Just start now. It's pointless to have regrets about where you think you should be or where others are. Just start where you are right now. The third thought is cause and effect. And this is a very positive thought. Right actions produce right results. And the reverse is true. So we can and should look at what goes on in our minds every day, because it is in our minds, through our thoughts, that our actions are initiated. So every day we should be spending some time. How did I spend my time today? Where was it? What's my goal to? Was I kinder, more compassionate today or not? This kind of review is really, really critical. We get that advice almost the first day we enter a center, but it's often the first advice we forget when we leave the center. Take a review of what your day was like. The fourth thought is, at the end of our life, at death, all the trophies we collect, all the friends we have, all the relatives we know and love, all the projects we have completed, all are going to be left behind. So all that we will carry forward in our stream of consciousness, the only thing we'll carry forward is the imprint of our good and bad deeds. So we need to recognize again the futility of samsaric effort. Doesn't mean we're not attempting to be helpful to our fellow beings or make our efforts in that direction. We should. It's a part of our bodhisattva commitment, and it creates merit. But all of our ordinary mundane activity will leave behind. In the book, One Single Virtue, Kala Rinpoche says, as long as we do not come to a deep and definitive resolution about what we are doing and where we are headed and what we are trying to do, then we will remain in a state of delusion and denial. Sad to say. In a remarkable statement, he further says, we can practice Dharma for years, but if we do not come to any kind of decisive resolution as to as a result of the four thoughts, the whole practice of Dharma will only increase our arrogance, our jealousy, our competitiveness, and our selfishness. And dare I say, you can find that in many Dharma centers. People who haven't really come to understand the nature of those four thoughts and whose practice has only increased their arrogance or their jealousy or their competitiveness, all silly, all stupid, all non-dharmic activity. If you do not turn your mind away from the meaninglessness of samsaric thoughts and efforts, if we don't do that, all your practice and all my practice and all my meditation won't really matter. Because your craving for and fixated on samsara, and it will increase, not decrease. Your state of mind and your behavior will actually get worse, harder and more rigid, and nothing will work. On the other hand, and this is the note I would want to leave you with, on the other hand, if you give rise to that desire for freedom, that desire you often had when you first came to the Dharma Center, you become capable of practicing all sorts of profound practices. But it begins in our detachment from samsara and our devotion to practice, to teachers, and to our own effort. How far you get depends on two things, really. Your karma, which none of us really know or understand. And if we understand it, we understand it very imperfectly. But what we do know, and this is what Rinpoche said to us when I was first day of retreat, he said, you don't know how far you will get. Part of it's depend upon your karma, but I can tell you for sure that if you make an effort, if you persevere in that effort, you will make progress. There's no doubt about that. He guaranteed it to all of us. And so, trusting Rinpoche's advice, I give the same to you. That if you make the effort, if you persevere in whatever practice you're doing right now, you'll make progress. So, to end this talk, please find some time to contemplate the four thoughts. I would especially urge those who may be feeling that they want to make greater progress and feel a little disheartened to go back to those four thoughts. Run them over, contemplate them in your mind. Take a little time to contemplate them, and then make the resolutions that those four thoughts provide. Again, I want to thank you for your time. We'll end up a few minutes early. I want to thank you for your time. It's always really special to be able to come here. I'm very happy to have this opportunity, and I hope when we complete the center that all of us can meet there. In the meantime, we'll continue to meet over the internet. I want you all to have a really good week, and occasionally from time to time, maybe on a daily basis, recollect where are you placing your attention? Thank you very much, and have a great week. Bye-bye.
Thank you for joining us for this week's Dharma Talk. We hope you enjoyed the podcast. If you did, please subscribe, rate, and review it on iTunes. To learn more about the Columbus Karma Teksum Choling or to donate to support our Dharma Talk series, please visit our website at columbusktc.org. The opening and closing music for the podcast is Tibetan Flute Song by Tamding Arts at tamdingarts.com. Please join us again next week for another Dharma Talk.